From the Ryerson Review of Journalism, this is Pull Quotes. I'm Emily Pardo.
And I'm Laura Howells. So we're doing something a little different this week because the Ryerson Review just published its annual magazine.
Now, we're a little biased since these were written by our colleagues, but there's some pretty interesting stories in there about Canadian journalism.
Yeah, and we talked about some of these stories in our previous episodes, like the feature on cannabis journalism, for instance, or the story about all the gross online harassment that women in the news industry have to deal with.
Sadly, we can't cover everything on this podcast, but we wanted to highlight a few more of the magazine features in this episode.
So today you're going to hear more conversations with Ryerson Review journalists about their work. And first up is reporter Emma Bedbrook, who looked at the ethical minefield of undercover journalism.
Going undercover can lead to incredible stories, but it can also make for a lot of ethical challenges.
Here's Emily's chat with Emma Bedbrook.
Thanks for joining us, Emma.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit about your feature?
So my feature is about undercover reporting, specifically the ethics of it. Every time a journalist goes undercover, it's like a case-by-case scenario, and I was just looking at how some journalists do that.
So can you tell us a little bit about the journalists that you talked to and the kind of stories they had to tell you?
Yeah, the first journalist I talked to and was Jan Wong, and I was so excited to talk to her. She told me about this series she did in 2006 called Made for a Month. It was started out as looking at minimum wage at the time and if somebody could survive just working a minimum wage job. So instead of just talking to people, she decided to actually live that life and really immersed herself in undercover by getting a job as a maid, living in an apartment that she could afford on minimum wage and taking her two sons with her, and all living on $7 an hour. I talked to Kate Fillion. She actually was working for the Toronto Life in 1990 and went undercover in high school as a student, and that was crazy to me because I don't think anything like that could happen today. And the last person I included in my story was Shaughnessy Bishop Stahl. He wrote a book called Down to This, and it was about Toronto's tent city. And he was there for basically a year and just lived on like unemployment checks, lived in like a shack that he built himself with a lot of other people that were there, and wrote about it.
So what do you think are some of the main ethical challenges that these journalists are facing?
I think that probably the biggest one is how much to reveal about a source, especially when they're unwitting, they don't know they're being talked about, recorded. And there's no good answer for it. There's no uniform answer. It's always case by case. And in my story, we talk about Jan Wong revealing information about a source named Maggie, and that's a pseudonym. They changed her name. Maggie was a maid in the Made for a Month story. She was partnered with Jan a lot, a really great cleaner and a good person, and didn't know she was being recorded. But they reveal a lot of personal information about her, about like her abusive marriage and like her OCD, her need for perfection when she's cleaning, and just a lot of things that Jan herself didn't think that Maggie would want included, but she did it anyways. And there's so much dispute around that because on one hand, you got the story out of it and you got like the need to show that working Canadian women are facing these problems. But on the other hand, you know that Maggie would not be happy with it. So you have to balance how they're going to feel in the story. And that's like always different.
Yeah. So how did Jan come to decide to even include her in the story if it was such a hard decision to make?
Yeah. Jan said that she was just necessary because the story was about, could you survive on minimum wage and show that Canadian women were working like these very hard jobs? And Maggie was just the perfect candidate to show those things happening. But also she showed the other sides of Maggie that, like her as a person, her day to day. And it was like, obviously in a complimentary light because she was friends with Maggie at the time. And I think it was probably a really hard decision because I would say like they were friends and you had to do it for the story.
So say in the case of Jan, when she was being a maid for a month and she became friends with Maggie, how much would she tell her before she published her story?
She didn't tell her anything. I think Maggie was totally blindsided by the story. It was hard for Jan, I know that, to not tell Maggie about it before they went to publication, but she was told by the lawyers at the Globe that it would be best not to talk to her because they didn't want anything to halt the publication. Yeah, she never contacted Maggie again. Like, ever. Never.
Wow.
I know, it seems hard to fathom. I would definitely feel like being friends and having to work together for a month and really get to know each other, to never talk to her again, never see her again. Although she thinks that Maggie probably didn't like the series, she was never able to confirm that.
Hmm.
Jan never explicitly said that there was an ethical problem with never going to see Maggie again, but I think personally it was hard. As a friend, to never talk to somebody again, that must be kind of hard. Especially you, as a reader, it's also hard because you kind of want to know, you kind of get attached to Maggie and you feel for her and you never get a follow up on how she's doing or how she reacted to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did any of the writers talk about maybe an ethical issue about developing these relationships with their sources in general?
Well, the one that I can think of is Kate.
Mm-hmm.
When she went undercover in high school.
There was a student that you mentioned in your story that she had come in contact with where she had to actually reveal herself as a journalist, right?
Mm-hmm. It was a student who she became kind of like friends with and just became like an ear for them, like just a person that they could talk to. And he revealed a lot of things and the risk of self-harm became evident to her. And so she decided that she couldn't keep going and not do anything about it. So she revealed herself as like an adult and guided him towards like counselors and resources. But in the end, I think that was like a huge betrayal of trust for him. And I don't think he ever really forgave her for that.
Mm.
He didn't know that he was talking to somebody that wasn't a student, not wasn't his own age. And probably shocking. I think I would be shocked too if somebody did that to me. Shaughnessy, after his book was published, he still went and visited some of the people at Tent City, both out of like a little bit of sense of obligation probably and friendship. You know, they had known each other for a year. But eventually he said that it just became too hard to revisit that life and move forward. But I can imagine that being hard because they were close and only a handful of the people that he considered friends are even alive today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So when you dove into this, what kind of struck you as the biggest ethical concern?
I think that was probably what sources to protect, if you were able to protect sources as a journalist. And that was just such a hard situation to cover because different journalists have different perspectives on that. Shaughnessy was open to protecting sources in his book because they were friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's pretty common now that people use pseudonyms. Mr. Stevens was a pseudonym, so was Maggie. But that didn't protect them from people that read the story and knew about them. So I think that's probably the biggest issue, or the one that most jumped out to me was, who do you protect? Are you allowed to protect them?
Mm-hmm.
You went undercover to write this story and to get like the bigger picture, and is it okay to kind of sacrifice them for the public interest of the story?
That was Emma Bedbrook. Her feature in the Ryerson Review is called Hide and Seek, The Ethics of Going Undercover.
Terrorism is a pretty loaded term, and when you hear it in news reports, it can say a lot.
Maria Iqbal is the editor of the Ryerson Review, and she wanted to look at how journalists decide to use the word terrorism. To do that, she examined the reporting on a 2006 plot known as the Toronto 18.
Here's Laura talking to Maria about what she found.
So, I guess to start off, what was the case known as the Toronto 18?
The Toronto 18 case was a major terrorism investigation that took place in Toronto. It led to the arrest of 18 people, mostly men, and like there were four youth who were male. It took place in 2006, which was fairly close to 9/11, and you know, soon after the legislation had been passed, the anti-terrorism legislation had been passed in Canada.
So this was a plot. Nothing actually came about from it. But what were these people accused of wanting to do?
Right. So they were accused of wanting to bomb three sites, two of which were in Toronto. And they organized some training camps to kind of help with that. There was debate over the precise nature of these training camps, whether or not they were actually terrorism training camps or kind of just, you know, nonsense retreats. And they ordered 3 tons of ammonium nitrate to help build their bombs. And it was while that chemical, it was actually substituted by the police who had been following up with this case and kind of following what the individuals involved were doing. And they substituted the ammonium nitrate with a fake substance. And it was when that fake substance was delivered to some of the group members that the raids and arrests began.
So why is this something that you decided to write about and write this feature on?
It's really interesting because before I started, I didn't actually know anything about the Toronto 18. And so initially the story was what I had intended to kind of investigate is how is it that media outlets decide when to call something terrorism? And this was something that kind of was something that people talked about a lot. Like I would see it on social media that, you know, when a terrible attack took place and people died, there would always be this kind of moment of, okay, like hold your breath. Who is the culprit? And if they're a Muslim, is it terrorism? So it was just interesting because there was no, like, I didn't have any background into how journalists or news organizations made this kind of decision. And, you know, being in journalism school, this was not really something that we covered. And also, it was interesting for me personally, just being a Muslim woman myself, and, you know, going about my day. And, you know, I've had incidents, not very often, but incidents nonetheless, where people have said to me just because of what I'm wearing, something like, you know, don't shoot, as though they expected me to be a violent person. And of course, it's easy for a lot of people to kind of blame the media for this kind of stereotype that people have. But I thought, I'm a student of journalism. Why don't I explore if it's really the media's fault? And if it is, why?
So when you looked at the coverage of the Toronto 18 case, what did you find out in terms of why the term terrorism was applied to this case?
One thing that's interesting is that when I was interviewing people about this story, like I asked them, you know, so why is it that, you know, this was called terrorism? And I mean, the answer seems clear in hindsight because they were charged with terrorism and many of them were convicted. But that was actually the kind of nugget of information that I think the main thing that I took away from this. A lot of the time, news outlets rely on the legal system or politicians to call something terrorism, and then they repeat that in their coverage or they quote it in their coverage. When I looked at newsroom policies on using the word terrorism, it was very similar. Their definition was very similar to what our legal system has as its definition for terrorism, which is basically violence or the threat of violence that's carried out with some larger motive, an ideological or political motive behind it. And I was surprised by that. Maybe I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised because journalism is supposed to be independent of the state. But the way that newsrooms were defining terrorism was completely on the state's terms. And that's something really controversial because there's no consensus on what the word terrorism means.
What do you mean by that?
One thing is that people have brought up, you know, whether or not we even need terrorism laws to begin with. And one really timely example of this question is the current trial of Alexandre Bissonnette in the Quebec mosque shooting. Many people are talking about the fact that he hasn't been charged with terrorism. And that also means that in our coverage, he's not being referred to as a terrorist, minus opinion pieces and whatever people have to say about it. But the fact remains that a large number of people who are brown or Muslim are called terrorists and charged with terrorism. One of my sources actually for this story, a professor named Yasmin Jawani of Concordia University, brought up the fact that what we consider as a quote-unquote ideology, both in the legal system and also by extension in our news policies, it plays a huge part in who falls under this terrorism box. People who identify with extremist elements in Islam are very easily put into that box, while right-wing radicals, as we're seeing, are not.
Right, right. And I mean, it recently was confirmed that Alexander Bissonnette, his actions were motivated by a fear of Muslims and involved violence with a political motive. And Les Perreux points out in the Globe and Mail that, you know, this is sort of the dictionary definition of terrorism, yet he's not charged with terrorism, so he's not getting the label terrorist.
Exactly. And I think one thing that's really important is not just it is important to kind of apply our legal charges equally across, you know, similar crimes should receive similar kinds of charges. But also just in terms of how people are remembered in the media, I think it plays a huge role, because when a large number of Muslims or people who are non-white are accused with terrorism, it lends to these stereotypes that of the other and of what terrorism is. And when people like Alexandre Bissonnette are not charged with terrorism, it kind of continually reinforces that narrative.
Even if the courts might not be deeming somebody a terrorist, do you think journalists have a responsibility to use that label where, you know, politicians or the courts might not?
It's a really difficult question, and people will have different opinions of it. Of course, people will argue that journalists are not supposed to call themselves someone a terrorist because we're supposed to be objective. But when we rely on the state or public officials to call something terrorism or not, then we suddenly become almost propaganda tools for the state and kind of reinforce this the state narrative and forego our own independence. So it's a really difficult question to navigate. And I think that I don't quite know what the answer is. But some people that I spoke to for this story suggested that at the very least, what news outlets can do is when someone calls something terrorism, a public official, for example, journalists, they can and should quote those officials using that word, but they should ask, you know, interrogate a little bit, why are you using this word? And in this case, how does it apply? Just so that the reader then becomes aware of kind of the nuances and they can kind of make up their own mind about whether or not something is terrorism or not.
So you were looking at this question through the Toronto 18 case where there were terrorism-related charges. I mean, do you think that remembering this plot as a terrorism-related plot, it's fair?
I think one thing that people should bear in mind is that even right now, we're using this term Toronto 18. When at the end of the convictions, at the end of the court case, there were 11 convictions. So I think what's worth understanding is that, and worth remembering, is that these individuals who were arrested and charged all had varying levels of involvement in the case. Some were more heavily involved than others, and in those cases, they should have those terrorism charges, and I think it was right that they were given those. But I don't think it's fair for the seven, for example, whose charges were stayed, to be remembered as part of the Toronto 18, because as far as we know, they were innocent.
So what do you think journalists should be doing differently or maybe questioning more when they're doing this kind of reporting?
I think for me, one big takeaway is that just acknowledging now that it is the case that we rely very heavily on the state for when we call something terrorism, and acknowledging that that's a problem. I think it would be a good move for news organizations to be more transparent about their use of the word terrorism. And I know there's been more discussion about it in the past, over the past several months. I think they should be clearer with their readers about their policies. And they are available online in several cases, but I think they should be much more prominent and within the actual coverage of an event. an outlet should be clear about why the word terrorism is being applied or why it's not. And I think we as journalists should interrogate public officials more about why they're using certain words, as well as some of the details that we choose to include in our stories. Like, for example, oftentimes we see a violent person or someone who's called a terrorist. The news report will quote the person who is accused of the crime as having shouted Allahu Akbar or something of that nature at the scene. And for many people who know, it's an Arabic term that means Allah or God is the greatest. And it's a phrase that's used very commonly by Muslims every day in their prayers. But it's become almost like a fetish in media reports when it comes to terrorism to mention that somebody said that word, almost as an indication that a terrorist event took place even before the legal charges have been laid. And I think what news organizations fail to do a lot of the time is to give context to what this term is, because for the vast majority of Muslims who are practicing their faith peacefully, it doesn't have any kind of connection to violence. It's something that is recited multiple times a day during our prayers. So I think when we include details like that, we should be clear about what it means and what for the majority of Muslims, and not just the way it's being appropriated by someone who committed an act of violence.
That was Maria Iqbal. You can read her feature, called Making a Terrorist, in the Ryerson Review.
Okay, so for our last conversation today, Emily talked to Dagmuit Dejeuner. She looked at how Canadian journalists are reporting on the far right. Here's a bit of that conversation.
Thanks for joining us, Dagmuit.
I'm happy to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you were reporting on?
So basically for this project, I did a story on the far right in Canada, which is kind of the equivalent to the alt-right in America. So most of these groups, they range a lot in their ideologies. So you can get a group like La Muette, which is in Montreal or in Quebec in general, and they are anti-immigration and to a certain extent anti-Muslim. And then you have some groups that are completely like white nationalists. My story is focused on how Canadian journalists are reporting on these far-right groups and, you know, all the responsibilities that come with that kind of subject matter.
So how are people reporting on it?
So the thing that I found was a lot of journalists were kind of struggling with this because there's a lot of context that has to come with reporting on hate groups in order for someone who's reading the newspaper to get the full information. But as a journalist, you have that responsibility to really focus on the context and like how they came about and how they came up with those kind of beliefs and report that in a way that people can understand and can kind of make their own judgments, because you don't want to just like push your own judgment onto the page, right? Mm-hmm. So what I found was that a lot of journalists are doing quite a good job of this.
So what was your experience when you were reporting on this issue?
Well, when I first brought it up to Steve, my professor, he was like, you should go out and interview these groups. And I was kind of like, no thanks. I'd rather not, like, being a Black woman. I wouldn't exactly feel safe in these kind of groups. So I decided it was more important to tell a story of how other journalists are doing this instead of trying to report on them myself and kind of taking it on myself. And it was kind of tricky to find people who were focusing their journalistic work on this topic. But once I did find them, I found that everyone was really willing to speak about it. And they really wanted to like conversate and kind of have that debate on what should be the normal practice of covering a subject matter like this, and like what's not working and what's actually aiding these groups and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was reading in your feature that a couple of them actually had conflicting ideas of how it should really be reported on.
Yeah. Some people that I spoke to believe that journalists should not include their own bias into their reporting or their own opinion.
So in that case, you wouldn't write in a story like, this group is racist, because you're kind of putting that bias on them. But other journalists found that it was actually not a bias, but just stating a fact. So if you can prove that this group is racist and they've done racist things, then you're not actually being biased in your reporting when you say blank is a racist group.
Can you tell us about the kind of things that you heard from these journalists, like stories of dealing with these groups?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to one journalist named Evan Balgord, and he has done a lot of reporting on these groups in Toronto specifically. And his experience was kind of a little unique because I found that they were really confrontational towards him, and they like knew his face. And every time he'd show up to a rally or something, he would be singled out and people would like target him almost. So he was saying that he has to take a lot of safety precautions and, you know, make sure that, you know, he is safe when he's out there reporting.
In dealing with some of these groups, I know as well some of the journalists you talked to had developed some kind of a relationship, but they weren't necessarily like a personal relationship, right?
No. So my main character, Jonathan Monpetit, has kind of developed, you would call it like a very professional relationship with some of these groups, and they invite him to their rallies and they invite him to like some of their meetings and stuff. Because what you don't realize about these groups is they really want the publicity and they really want their voices heard. So he kind of gives them a platform to do that. But that's also a lot of responsibility on him to make sure he's not just putting their propaganda out into the world without making sure that everything they say is correct.
Mm-hmm. You spoke to Nora Loretto. She's an activist and a journalist based in Quebec. And she had said that the majority of journalists that have taken on the responsibility about writing about the far right are white. As a person of color and a journalist, what do you think about that?
I think it kind of makes sense if you think about it in the way that white journalists have more access to this kind of topic, and they're more likely to get, you know, the interviews, and people in these groups won't be so, like, against talking to them. And also, there was something that one of my sources said that kind of stuck with me. He told me, you know, for a person of color, these groups are not exactly surprising. So they're not like, oh my God, this exists, because as a person of color, you've kind of experienced that kind of bigotry in your life. So that kind of stood out to me, because I guess for a white journalist, seeing that there are groups that are anti-immigration or anti-Muslim or anti like any other kind of person of color, that would be kind of surprising to you, because it's not something that you grew up with in your culture or something that you've faced or seen. So I think white journalists are more interested in this topic because it's kind of new to them, you know? Whereas for a person of color, it's not exactly a new idea.
Mm-hmm. One major problem, too, as well, seems to be the issue of language and terms that journalists are using. Like, say they use the words far right or hate groups or racist. How do journalists at the moment decide which terms they should be using and when they should be using them?
I think that really depends on what the journalist feels is the most accurate. I think it's important not to let these groups label themselves. So a lot of groups will try and label themselves as anti-immigration. But if you like really look into what they're doing and what they say, like on their private websites and stuff, you'll see that they're actually anti like all races except white, you know? So definitely make sure you're not only referring to them by what they refer to themselves as, because they can definitely mislead you. So it's kind of like your responsibility as a journalist to make sure you're using the word that best describes the group you're talking about.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today.
This was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
That was Dagmoit Dejeuner. You can read her feature, Covering the New Hate, in the Ryerson Review magazine. Well, that's it for Poll Quotes this week. I hope you enjoyed this little audio taste of the Ryerson Review magazine. Pick up the actual magazine at Indigo or order one at rrj.ca, where you should soon be able to read those articles online.
Pull Quotes is a production of the Ryerson Review of Journalism. It's produced by Jacob McNair, Laura Howells, and me, Emily Pardo.
Big, big thank you to Angela Glover for putting up with us in the studio and all her help there. And a special thank you to Sonia Fata, who has provided a lot of help and support this year.
Well, the semester is over at Ryerson University, so we're not sure when we're actually going to see you again. But it's been a blast.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find me on Twitter at LauraHowellsNL. Emily, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter. My handle is Emily C. Pardo.
You can always email Pull Quotes and provide your feedback. We're at pullquotes@ryerson.ca. Thank you for everything, and hope you all have a great spring and a great summer. See ya.